Hey, what is up? Welcome to this Featured Friday episode of the Wantrepreneur to Entrepreneur podcast. I am so excited about the guest that I've got here with us today. His name is Jeff Morrell. This guy has built an absolute entrepreneurial empire. He's the founder of Planet Subaru, which is based in my good old home state of Massachusetts. He's also the author of Profit Wise, How to Make More Money in Business by Doing the Right Thing. He's also got business enterprises in real estate, telecommunications, insurance, so many things that all together do over $100 million in revenue. This guy's the man. I'm not going to hold him back any longer. Without further ado, let's dive into my interview with Jeff Morrell. Jeff, welcome to the Entrepreneur to Entrepreneur podcast.
Thanks for having me on. I'm excited to talk with another former Bostonian to see if we can detect any evidence of a Boston accent in either one of us.
Heck yeah. Actually, you and I were talking a little bit before I hit record. The number one piece of feedback that I get when people email me is they're just like, why do you have a Canadian accent? I get that more than anything else, Jeff.
It's funny. I lived in Boston for 20 years, spent the rest of my life in Virginia. And the most common thing that people say about me, they ask if I'm from Pennsylvania for whatever reason, which is actually about halfway between the two. So maybe that makes sense.
So random. You're the average of the two states you've lived in. Well, Jeff, I want to dive into your story. You obviously heard me tell listeners a little bit about yourself. Fill in the gaps for us. Who is Jeff as a person, as an entrepreneur?
Well, Joyce Carol Oates, a novelist, she likes to start her novels with the last line, the finishing line of the novel, instead of all the other different ways you can do that. Now, I'll take that cue and start from where I'm sitting right now, which is in Charlottesville, Virginia. I actually grew up in Virginia. And in my mid-20s, my brother and I, who were both independently working for different car businesses, he for Ford Motor Company, and I'd accidentally ended up in a Volvo dealership because I couldn't find any other job when I graduated from college. We decided to buy a bankrupt Subaru dealership just outside of Boston. That was in 1998. So we didn't have a lot of money. We had a lot of enthusiasm. And it's been quite a journey since then. That's roughly, what's that, 23 years ago now. And we've learned a lot about the kind of the personal dimensions of being an entrepreneur, which are probably the more important ones even than the financial ones, because you don't have to live your bank account, but you do have to live your life. So I'm hoping we can spend a little time talking about those things, what it's like to grow a business and the costs along the way and the benefits and how I've perceived those and maybe some recommendations to people who don't yet own businesses to maybe avoid the mistakes that I made. Because I actually burned out. And the reason I'm back in Virginia, even though the businesses that we still own are in Boston, is because I had put in too many hours, too much intensity for too long, and I wasn't monitoring my battery level. And by the time I started making the changes I need to back off, it was really too late. I was just done. I was spent on business. So now from Charlottesville, still owning the businesses, I work with our management team remotely at a much reduced amount of emotional and time investment, which I can sustain. But I could never imagine going back to that full-time 5, 6, 7 day a week routine that I was in for so long.
I love it. And that's something that I hear so frequently from entrepreneurs and entrepreneurs within this podcasting audience and community is, you know, they hear that advice from so many people, like Gary Vee's telling you to always be hustling, always be hustling. And there's a time and a place. We've all lived through that. But Jeff, I do want you to take us back to your earlier days. So you guys bought a failed dealership. What were your early days like as an entrepreneur? What were the initial struggles that you were getting? And what were, I also want to hear from you because I love talking about struggles, but I also want to hear what were some of those things that kept you going throughout those struggles?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you're young, you have a lot of ambition and a lot of, you just want to, you have curiosity. You want to see if your vision, your strategies will actually work. And that was really neat to start. The business we bought was, it opened in February of 1998, closed in August, and lost $400,000 in between. So we were buying a business that was already losing money. Like it was, there was cash flow, but more of it was going out the door than every month and was coming in. So we opened in October. The doors had literally been locked for a couple of months and we had to kind of crank it back up. And we understood that what had killed the prior business was a lack of management attention and also a lack of a good model. Like they had just opened up a traditional dealership that was exploitive, filled with the typical shenanigans. It wasn't really matched to the Subaru customer, which really appreciates transparency. They're very well educated. So we turned that completely upside down and we call our business the Undealership. We've since opened a Jeep dealership with the same philosophy. And what we're trying to do is differentiate ourselves in a crowded marketplace by offering experience that other dealerships can't. And there are a lot of reasons why they can't. There's fear on their part. There's inertia on their part. There's a lack of imagination on their part. So they've created a rich environment for us to run circles around them. And anyone who's bought a car recently in a traditional, typical dealership can speak to the broken model. So I think that was really, really a key part of it. And to speak to your question specifically about the successes and what kept us going is it was just fun to see it work. It was fun to see people respond well to it, the customers that appealed to it. And one of the things that was also part of our early model, because we didn't have much money to advertise, is trying to attract a lot of earned media, which I discuss in my book, Profitwise, that was released earlier this year, how you can attract attention from people who will spread the word for you so that you don't have to write checks to appear in newspapers and on TV and that kind of thing. So I don't think anything we did that I recall attracted TV crews. But back then, the newspapers were more influential than they are now. And we were able to get a lot of newspaper articles based on the zany stuff we were doing and the innovative stuff we were doing. Like we one of the very rare dealerships that was hiring a lot of women at the time, which we still do. And that's when you do those kinds of things, you can attract the attention during that time of media outlets. But and now, you know, in terms of the there's a whole wide world via the web of people who would be excited to share your message when they share your values and want to make sure you succeed.
Yeah. So Jeff, clearly it didn't take you very long to go where I knew you'd go at some point in this interview, which is you're already talking about running an undealership. You're already talking about doing things differently. You've already said the word values. And obviously a big part of your entrepreneurial story, why I love your story so much, is that you genuinely do believe in doing entrepreneurship the right way. Talk to us about that distinction. What are some of the mistakes that you see entrepreneurs and business people in general making? And to you, what is that right way?
A business is going to reflect the values of the people in charge of running it. And Ralph Waldo Emerson said that an institution is the lengthened shadow of one person. And in my case, maybe you could say it was the two brothers, me and my brother John, who started the business. And those values that you open the dealership with, they're going to really impact the kind of people you hire, kind of decisions that you make in terms of what kind of brand you want to have. And so I like to think of starting a business with the values front and center. And that's an important step, I think, for people thinking about starting a business. If you want to start a landscaping company or a plumbing company or any other kind of company, I think it's important to think about how you're going to differentiate yourself from all the other people offering those services and why your values give you a competitive advantage. So in our case, you know, my brother and I, we do not have a killer instinct. You know, we just don't. Like, that's not the way we operate. And so we knew we were never going to climb to the top of the pile using ruthless business strategies. We're just a couple of ordinary, nice guys who want to see other people succeed along with us. And that idea kind of powers everything we do with the dealership. So one of the things I'm really proud of, we have a lot of women turning wrenches as technicians. Nationwide, about 1% of automotive technicians is women, which is a shocking statistic when you think about that women are about 50-51% of the population. Only 1% of them are found turning wrenches in automotive shops. And we realized we were missing out on a ton of potential, a ton of opportunity to help us supply all the help we needed to fix the number of cars that we had as we grew. And so we said, well, what can we do that will serve our needs, increase the amount of labor we have available to do this, and simultaneously improve our corner of the world and improve the communities that we serve? And certainly when we're bringing in people that have been traditionally excluded from the pretty good jobs in automotive retail, then we're going to help strengthen those individuals, the families that their income supports, and even in the neighborhoods where that income allows them to fix up their houses. And there's this multiplier effect, a flywheel effect, if you will, that supporting people that have traditionally been excluded from those opportunities creates in our communities. And so all of this, to go back to the beginning of the answer and your question, all this starts from the things that are important to me and my brother. And then we attracted people who shared those interests and values. And it only makes sense that once you fill an organization with people who see the world that way, then the kind of values that we're talking about are going to get expressed in the activities of the business. So anyway, the short answer is, make sure before you get into business, or if you just got into business, figure out who you are and what you're going to do for the world more than just earn an income.
Heck yeah. I love that answer for so many different reasons. There's so many things to unpack within there. And in my mind, there's two ways that we could go from here. Obviously, we could talk about the strategic, the tactical side of business, and also the mindset stuff. So I definitely want to dive into the mindset stuff with you for sure. But first, I do want to speak directly to the entrepreneurs and entrepreneurs who are listening to us right now. And they're thinking, well, Jeff, you bought a failing business, and I have tried a million different things when it comes to starting my business. What were the strategic shifts that you went through to turn a business that was in debt, losing money month over month, to actually flourishing? What were some of those shifts you made?
Well, as I mentioned before, just the very vision that we brought, you know, just the model. Like, there are a lot of ways you can run a business, and one of the decisions that you make early on is, are you going to do the hunting method, which is, are you going to slaughter every customer that you get? You know, if you're, let's just use a plumbing company example, are you going to do a $100 sink repair at a customer's house and charge $350 for it and not care whether they come back? Or are you going to charge $100 for a $100 repair and hope that you can build a relationship that will be worth a lot more than $300 over the life of your relationship with that customer? So I think that the model and the vision that you have is one of those things that we thought about that we're going to replace. And another thing is that we knew that we were going to work a lot harder than the people who were running the business and would run it into the ground. And we were willing to sacrifice our emotional and physical health for a period of time to make sure that we could keep our expenses modest in terms of personnel and get the company to break even, so that we could grow from there. So I think those are really important. Maybe the most important thing after you've defined this reality that I'm talking about, where you've understood your realities, and I have a chapter of the book devoted to that notion of defining reality and kind of laying out who you're going to be in the world and in business, is then thinking about who are the people that are going to do it for you, who are going to execute on this vision that you have. And in most businesses, I mean, unless you're a solopreneur, you're going to end up hiring sooner rather than later. And you definitely want to acquire the skills to select from a pool of people who's going to be most aligned with your vision as an entrepreneur and who's going to be able to serve your customers in the way that you would like them served. And it took us a long time to figure out our system. We didn't have any system at all when we started. And that's why I lay out in the book all the steps that you need to do that well, so that you can, in a chapter, learn everything it took me about 15 years to learn, and hopefully it'll save you some of the pain.
I love hearing that, especially because it is so frequently a topic that guests bring up here on the Featured Friday episodes, is they always talk about hiring. It's such a key part of building something that's sustainable, of building something that's bigger than yourself, and of building something that's able to serve a heck of a lot more people in a really positive way if you can align those strategic hiring lessons and approaches and strategies. So we could probably do a whole episode about hiring, Jeff, but I am going to direct people to pick up a copy of your book, Profitwise. We're going to talk all about it at the end of today's episode. So instead of going down the hiring route with you, I do want to go back. You talked about you and your brother sometimes sacrificing your health and maybe your sanity up front talk to us about the mindset stuff. Obviously, that's a huge topic for newer entrepreneurs and, of course, for wantrepreneurs. Let's start going down that rabbit hole.
Yeah, I think it's lonely to start a business, even when my brother and I had each other, which was really great. I mean, not to go down too far down that road of partnerships, because they have a lot of liabilities, but it was very helpful that the two of us were experiencing that together. I can only imagine what it would have been like alone without having that shoulder to cry on, because you can't really come home to your spouse and talk about all the difficulties and the stresses at the risk of freaking your spouse out, that maybe the business isn't going to survive. So you have to be really careful about managing the way you communicate with your spouse. And you have to be selective in a way that maybe wouldn't be with a friend or a business partner like I had. But it was a lot of ups and downs. I think the startup energy at the beginning, you know, remember, we didn't move this from a side hustle and scale it. We just jumped all in. You know, we sold what few assets we had to move up to Massachusetts to buy the business. We borrowed a few $100,000 to give us the working capital, and then a few $1 million more for the cars. So we just went in head first, and we knew we had to succeed because we had burned all the boats. And so you have to remember that we didn't really have a way to ease into this. So once we were in it, we were terrified. And I think the key motivating word, if I only picked one word that kept us going, was fear, because this was everything that we had worked for financially up until that point. We were young, you know, late 20s in my case, early 30s in my brother's. But that's a long time to work towards something and save and save and save. And the thought of losing it was just, we just weren't willing to go there. So for about 6 months, we worked 7 days a week. And for the next 10 years, we worked 6 days a week. And it was only then that we started backing off. And I don't think that was required, and I wouldn't recommend that. I think that if you're working 6 days a week several years into your business, you've probably made a mistake somehow. And my mistake was that I didn't pull back enough. I was too much of a control freak. Obviously, I had to learn how to delegate, but there were too many things that I wanted to do my way. And if I could go back in time, I would have promoted people earlier and let our managers take on more responsibility earlier so that I could have taken more time off. And that isn't to say that I needed to abandon the business. I just didn't need to be there every day. And it's easy in a business like ours where we're open 7 days a week to just completely overdo it. And you need to set the boundaries, and I didn't. You know, it was a mistake that I made. And that was really, really a tough part of it. But whatever, here we are now. I can't go back and change that. All I can do is change the decisions that are available to me now, which is why I'm now living in Virginia. And my brother and I abandoned our interest in adding more businesses. The businesses that we have, we're very satisfied with, and we have enough. And so we've decided that we're not going to spend the rest of our lives chasing. You very flatteringly describe what we've already built as an empire, but I wouldn't describe it that way. When there are some entrepreneurs out there with, you know, 50 dealerships. They're in their 70s and 80s, and they've spent their whole life doing it, and they're on their third wives. But that's not us. And it was an intentional decision for us that we have enough. You know, it's like our situation is very enviable that in middle age, we have this freedom to do what we want to do, and we have resources available to help the people we want to help. And in my case, I even had the time to write a book, which I had never done. And that was really important to me and a life goal that I wanted to share these lessons with people who might benefit from them.
Heck yeah. So many good things in there, Jeff. And it's so fitting that as you were talking, I don't know if I was imagining it or if listeners can also hear it. You just hear birds chirping in the background. And obviously I can see you here on video enjoying life in Virginia. So it is very cool to see the transition from that hustle life, from that startup life to where you are now. And obviously you mentioned the portfolio of businesses that you now own. Talk to us about that. How did you guys decide when was the right time to expand and what were the right things to expand into? Obviously, you've got entities in real estate, telecommunications, insurance. Talk to us about that process.
I think one of the mistakes that some business owners make is that they get greedy and they want the success to come faster than it should. And that's how they get into trouble with debt. And of course, economic circumstances can be cyclical. You know, what makes sense as a debt service in today's environment might not make sense a year from now or 3 years. from now when you still have many years left to pay on the debt. So we were so terrified when we opened, we felt like we were out on a tree limb, would be a metaphor that I'd use to describe that. And we wanted to come back at, from way out on the limb towards the trunk. So we were about 6 years in before we bought the second business. And that first 6 years, because we were profitable early and we were able to save money, and we bought, it's interesting, we specialize in buying distressed assets. So the second dealership we bought was similarly affordable because it was also bankrupt. And when you don't have to spend a lot and take on a lot of debt to open up the business, as long as you have the human resources to take care of it, that's a smarter way to do it, I think. And it's certainly the model that worked for us and one that I'd recommend. I'll also point out that the longer you're in business, the easier it gets to buy new ones. You know, I remember when we first opened the Subaru dealership, we got turned down by every bank that we applied to for financing, except one. And now I think I could, I think if I called 20 banks with our, not that we really need to borrow any money, but if we did, I think every one of them would approve us. So it gets a lot easier as you go along when you have a track record in terms of the expertise you've acquired, and you also have cash that you've saved up. So in terms of scaling traditional businesses, we're not talking here about, you know, app-based businesses like Instagram and Silicon Valley kinds of things, but the kind of businesses that most of your listeners are going to own, I think it's important to expand in a way that you don't have to take on a lot of debt to do it, and to make sure that you don't get stretched too thin so that the skill you have doesn't get spread out over too many businesses. And for us, it was just very organic. The businesses that we started, I'll give you an example. Our insurance business actually involves extended service contracts on vehicles. So the business was kind of right under our nose. We were already selling extended service contracts on vehicles that other companies sold to us, and we resold them, if you will. And at some point we said, well, we can do this. You know, we can start our own company. We have a steady stream of business because our customers already see value in these products. So we can offer a better service at a lower price. We control the claims, so that if someone has trouble, we can make sure that the thing's just handled for the customer's benefits. There are lots of advantages to setting up the way we did. And it just happens organically. So one thing before I close out that answer, I just want to point out that the way the tax code is set up, it's not particularly favorable to small business owners trying to grow. I remember our first year, it was in the early 2000s, where the business made $1 million. And I was like, wow, we're rich. And then I did the math on it and realized, well, we pay almost half of that in taxes. And then, you know, my brother and I had to live on a little bit. Let's say for round numbers, we were taking out $100,000 each to live on. So that left $300,000 in a business that had millions of dollars worth of debt. So it took a long time, and that's why businesses, I think, all the really rich people, you know, are old. It just takes a while when you're making money at that pace to pay down your debt and then build up the war chest to buy more businesses.
Yes. Again, Jeff, I love the way that you answer so many of these questions, because in this most recent answer, the thing that I keep hearing from you is that long-term thinking. And you also talked about organic growth. And one of the things I love so much inside of your book, Profit Wise, is you do talk about intention setting to get from who you are right now to who you want to be. And obviously, you've experienced so much growth over your entrepreneurial career. Talk to us about that process of growth, of becoming the person you want to be.
I think the skill of introspection, if you can acquire some, I guess it's a skill set. If you're comfortable examining your own behavior and the impacts it has on other people, then if you can figure out how to do that, then you're going to be set up well to reduce the number of repeat mistakes. And for me, I'll tell you, I have this prime directive in life. I'll call it that. I've actually borrowed that term from the original Star Trek, that my sort of animating principle, the thing that gets me out of bed and really keeps me going, is this idea that I want to live up to the trust that people have made in me. All the people that depend on me, I want to make sure I'm fulfilling those responsibilities and living up to those duties. And so if you start there, then I think that, I don't know how to capture the idea, but that will explain why. Yeah, I don't know, I'm kind of losing my train of thought. I'm sorry. Maybe you can help me refocus me here.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I understand why it is so difficult to explain, because for you, it's something that we lived, and I've experienced time and time again as entrepreneur, or as an entrepreneur, that some things can only be learned through experiencing it. And I'm sure that you found that so many times throughout your entrepreneurial journey, where you realize, holy cow, I knew that this was the case. To use like a really cliched example, we always hear as entrepreneurs, cash is king. And we understand it fundamentally, but until you're actually running your business and you see the power of cash and you see the power of leveraging that for further growth, you already talked about tax concepts that affect us as entrepreneurs. Until you actually live it and experience it, you can't really learn that. And so looking back at, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, yeah, that idea, I guess, to for me, the, I guess I have a little more clarity on it now that I'm thinking more deeply about it, that I just hate the pain of hurting other people and making mistakes. And I'd see that, you know, I'd see someone leave, or we'd have to fire that person. And I'd say, yeah, you know, it just hurt. It hurts so bad to do that, you know, to see someone walk out the door because we hadn't brought in the right person, we hadn't trained them properly, or we hadn't created a culture that would allow them to succeed, whatever it was. And so I was always very motivated because of that to try to figure out a way to wake up the next day and change my circumstances so that I wouldn't run the risk of that happening again, or at least reducing the risk of that happening again. So yeah, to the extent that I talk about intention setting in the book, I think what I'm asking people to do is to establish a vision in their own lives of who they'd like to be in the world. Maybe you have an anger problem, or maybe you have a hard time getting started at things, or maybe you have a hard time finishing things, or maybe you're relying on food or alcohol or marijuana to get you through the day instead of finding more healthy alternatives to deal with maybe some depression that you have or something like that. And the idea that I'm trying to develop in the book and explain here right now is I'd like to think that you can identify those things that are important to you and see where the gap is, you know, between where you are right now and where you want to be. And then get moving towards that. So I'll give you an example that involves a young woman I met who wanted to be a writer. And of course, I'm a writer, at least an aspiring one. And I asked her what she was working on, what she was writing. And she said she hadn't written anything. And I was like, well, how are you ever going to be an author if you don't start writing? You know, you don't get a publisher first. You have to write something and develop those skills. And then you'll have something that you can test in the world and show to other people, and you can get their feedback. And maybe you'll discover that after you do it, that writing is really hard and you don't even want to do it, you know, because it's just a lot of frustration. And really the satisfaction only really comes at the end, or at least that was the case for me once I had something that I really, really thought reflected my views on things. So there's an example of what I'm talking about, that my suggestion to her was, hey, go buy a $5 journal and start writing today. And you don't have to wait till tomorrow. You can do it today and start moving one step closer. And one step closer will get you exactly that far closer to your goal. But at least you're moving in the right direction. And if you take enough steps, eventually you get there.
Heck yeah. It's so true. Writers write, runners run. If you want to be a runner, go get a pair of running shoes and hit the sidewalk, hit the streets. It's absolutely true. Jeff, so many things about, one thing that I really respect about you as an entrepreneur and as a human being is that to you, business isn't just about profit. And to you, a lot of it is truly about living a life that is exceptional, whether it's business-wise, whether it's life-wise. And for you, they happen to be intertwined because you do inject so much of your values and so much of where you want to be into everything that you do. Talk to us. I want to really pick into the wisdom of Jeff Morrill right now. Talk to us about some of those learnings and growth that you've experienced where you've realized, you know what, this is what life is really about. This is why I do all the things that I do.
You mentioned before this distinction between short term and long term. And I like to use the term that I know how to make slow bucks. You know, I think it's very rare actually that anybody in business ever figures out the quick buck. There are some people that accidentally fall into it. I'm thinking the Instagram founders that started a company within a few years sold it to Facebook for $1 billion. It does happen, but you don't want to count on that. I mean, most of us are just kind of in for a long haul, operating in businesses that are very competitive, and we're trying to grind out every little advantage we can, and to differentiate ourselves for customers to appeal to them in a way that our competitors can't. I think I had an incident in my life that really shifted me, and I think perhaps other people are familiar, where a single moment can open your eyes and take you out of the ether of what you're doing and give you a chance to inspect your own behavior and see whether it conforms to your long-term aspirations in life. And I've always wanted to think that by the end of my life that I would have done something other than just earn a good living and have a nice house. You know, like that just wasn't going to be enough. So in 2018, I was in this very violent bike accident that almost removed my right leg from my body. They were able to, there was enough of it hanging on that they were able to screw it all back together. And I still don't get around like I used to. But I can walk, and I had about a year during which I wrote the book, and a year that I was pretty much in some version of constant pain. It was a very difficult time for me, and I thought that incident could have been the end of my life, and that was a really important moment for me to reflect on what I had accomplished relative to that goal of serving the world. And I realized that I probably hadn't done enough. You know, there were things that I was very proud of. I'm very proud of bringing the team together that we have at all of our businesses and creating what I call a sanctuary for them in terms of the freedom they have from the kind of terrible human resource practices that occur at a lot of companies, and especially in dealerships. And I like to think of it as a sanctuary for customers. So we serve them not only in terms of providing them vehicle service or insurance products, that kind of thing, but we give them a safe place where they know they're not going to get taken advantage of. So all those things are very meaningful to me, but I felt like to whom much is given, much is required. And I probably had a disproportionate amount of blessings come to me. And I don't know that I've bounced as many of those back into the world as I should have. So that moment for me was very important in that process of rehabilitation, thinking, having a lot of time to think about how much I depended on other people during that time and how much people had served me over the years. So since then, I've made a much more serious commitment to balancing that ledger. And I think that there's a time for everyone to do that, you know, where you can right size your priorities. But before I conclude the answer, I guess I'd just point out that you can do that along the way too. You know, long before we had the kind of money that was available to donate to organizations that are important to us and that kind of thing, there were still things I could do within the business that would serve my corner of the world. And I mentioned one earlier in terms of our hiring practices, you know, that I could support traditionally excluded people and build the community that way while I was also earning my living. And I think that's the main thesis of the book that I'm trying to capture in ProfitWise, is that you don't have to just write checks to charitable organizations and get poorer doing that. You can get richer by supporting other people. And the more people you support, as long as you do it intelligently, the more people that you help win, those people are going to be pretty interested in making sure you keep winning. And that's certainly been the case for us.
Jeff, what an incredible answer. Thank you so much for sharing that story with us and sharing those life lessons on top of the business lessons. One thing, I just want to call it out real quick. You talked about balancing the ledger, and I've never heard that accounting term used in this way when it comes to life. So I really, really love that perspective on things. Thanks for sharing that for us. As we come towards the end of this interview, I really do want to put your book front and center here, because you've shared so much wisdom that you've picked up all across your lifespan so far inside that book, ProfitWise: How to Make More Money in Business by Doing the Right Thing. Jeff, why the heck did you write the book, and why is it so important, particularly for the entrepreneur to entrepreneur community, to pick up a copy of that book?
Well, first, the reason I wrote it is that I'll let you in on a little secret. I don't think I've ever shared this publicly. I actually wrote it for our team. We have about 140 people, somewhere in that range. And when I first wrote it, it was not going to be a book. It was going to be an internal handbook. And the reason it was going to be internal for internal purposes, because there's a lot of secret sauce in there. There's a lot of the, I think, very hard-won knowledge that we had developed through very expensive mistakes over time. And I think it gives us a competitive edge. It was kind of like when Elon Musk released a lot of his electric vehicle technology patents. The world was surprised. And I surprised myself that by the time I was writing it, I was like, "This, I don't want to just keep this among our team, because I think there are these principles and these techniques that I've described. People can use that to improve the world while they're earning a living." And that's ultimately my aspiration. I'm very happy for someone to buy the book and improve their hiring system so that they do better financially. That's the big part of the book. But the other part is that my whole point is that while you're doing that, you can also reinvest in your community and improve your corner of the world. So I think that's kind of the reason I did it. And what was the second? You had the second part of the question that I'm not recalling.
Tell me? Listeners why it's so important for them individually as entrepreneurs or entrepreneurs to pick up a copy of the book.
Yeah. So we're talking philosophically here today, and I have one chapter devoted to these sort of big picture principles that we're describing. But I'm not really interested in death by platitude for readers, which is many of the business books that I've read. So most of the book is devoted to specific techniques that people starting a business or in an established business can use to improve many things within their business. So we mentioned before the hiring procedure. I start all the way backstream with in terms of recruiting ads. And the best way to write a recruiting ad that will generate enthusiasm for the kind of company you are and will increase the number of people that are applying so that you have a higher quality slate of people to choose from. So I was interested in making sure that people not only understood the big picture, that they could earn more money and sleep better at night by keeping their eye focused on the long term and what they could do to serve other people in the world, but also how you actually do it. And that's the thing that's missing, I think, from so many business books. And that was the gap that I'm filling here.
I love it. Jeff, you have been such a wealth of knowledge, a wealth of wisdom, a wealth of experiences here on today's show. I've loved having you on as a guest. And I'd love for you to tell listeners where they could learn more about you, pick up a copy of your book, and follow all the awesome things that you're doing.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. So jeffmorrill.com. That's jeffmorrill.com is my website, and they can buy the book there. There's also, for those people who can't afford to buy all the books they might want to read, which is the case that used to be me, you know, many years ago, there are a lot of resources on the website that business owners or people opening up a business can use. There's free chapters on opening a business and the questions you need to ask before you do that. There are a lot of resources that we use every day in terms of the interview templates that we use during our interviews to help guide us so that we don't end up spending that precious interview time talking about hobbies and where people went to school, that kind of thing. So jeffmorrill.com is the book. And if anyone's interested in just learning about this unusual dealership model that we have, that's planetsubaru.com.
Awesome. So you guys heard the link from Jeff right there. Just go to jeffmorrill.com, RRLL. So it's Jeff, MORRILL.com. Pick up a copy of your book. I have a copy of my own, and I will say ProfitWise is an incredible book. So thank you so much, Jeff, for sharing the book with the world. And thank you so much for coming on to the Wantrepreneur to Entrepreneur podcast.
Thank you, Brian. We'll see you later.
Sounds good.
Thanks for listening to the Wantrepreneur to Entrepreneur podcast with your host, Brian Lofermento. For show notes and to get a free copy of Brian's book, visit us online at thewantrepreneurshow.com.